just as Miles Davis asks, so what? We say, so what? Well, it's the start of spring, a time of renewal, good for all. Well, I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And we're building bridges.
We fight for bread and roses, too, a Women's History Month special.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill lofts gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we bother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses.
Now we fight for bread and roses, too, a Women's History Month special.
We're joined by Professor Lara Vapnick, author of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Modern American Revolutionary, and Breadwinners, Working Women, and Economic Independence, 1865 through 1920. Lara serves as a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians and is a contributing editor of the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History.
Lara Vapnick, good Women's History Month.
Thank you.
And the beginning of spring. Wow, what a conjuncture.
Yes, I know.
Talking
I know,
about intersectionality there. Revitalization. Isn't that what we do?
Yes, wonderful. And that song is such a great way to start.
Oh, it is indeed. Lara, you specialize in the history of gender and labor in the U.S. So we'll talk about women as the breadwinners and who built unions from fields to factories in the fight for gender equity and for bread and roses, too. But get us started on our sojourn by taking us into the role of immigrant garment workers in 1910 and what was effectively the start of International Women's Day.
I think a great place to start with all of this is the uprising of the 20,000, which was the first really mass strike of women workers that took place in New York City from November of 1909 until February of 1910. And as the name suggests, it was this massive strike by women who worked in the garment industry. And up until that point, there had been a lot of skepticism from the labor movement as to whether or not women were going to be interested in joining, whether they're going to be disciplined strikers. There were all kinds of questions about that. And I think after that strike and that massive walkout, which brought unionization to a really significant sector of the American economy, I think that really kind of answered those questions, and it showed that women really did have a strong role to play in the labor movement.
And the strike was organized and solidified by with the women themselves. It wasn't just outside forces coming in, right?
Definitely, yeah. It was really led by a number of immigrant women, people like Rose Schneiderman, Pauline Newman, women who had worked in the garment industry, who were immigrants themselves, and, you know, really, they were part of the whole thing. Now, they definitely got support from the Women's Trade Union League, and that was a group of, that was a cross-class group of women. And the Women's Trade Union League were really important, I think, in supporting the strikers, but the goal was to organize them into unions that were affiliated with the American Federation of Labor.
Lara, I must say that one of my favorites in history, although it's hard to pick in terms of women's labor history. But we always need to lift up names, and so I'm going to pick on, because you happen to have a book that deals with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. And I wonder if you would grace us with a reading from that book on Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Modern American Revolutionary, to continue to set the pace and fire our imaginations and recognize the role of women as breadwinners, the role of women as revolutionaries, as militants, as labor builders, then for now.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to do that, of course. And Flynn was really, I think, she, at this time, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, let me just say a little bit about her just for people who might not be familiar with her. She was born in, she lived from 1890 to 1964, and she spent most of her life in New York City, and she was an early organizer, agitator, actually, for the industrial workers of the world. And this was a group that was trying to take a more radical approach to labor organizing than the AFL was taking at the time. So the AFL, that's the American Federation of Labor, they were really focused on the labor aristocracy, the so-called labor aristocracy. They were focused on organizing skilled workers and organizing men. They weren't terribly interested in organizing women, although they were kind of pressed into it by the uprising of the 20,000. But Flynn was part of what was really a competing and more radical organization in many ways. But I think that she saw that 1909 to 1910 shirtwaist makers strike as sort of an opportunity to expand the organization of women, but to do it for the industrial workers of the world. She was very active in kind of coming in to help lead a strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. That's the famous Bread and Roses strike of January through March 1912. And so I'll just read a little bit from my book about that strike.
Thank you.
The IWW's dream of overcoming the divisions of sex, skill, and nationality to build working class solidarity came closest to fulfillment in the famous Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, a center of wool cloth production. On January 1, 1912, a new law went into effect in Massachusetts, reducing women's working hours from 56 to 54 a week. This legislation seemed to be a victory for reformers who advocated shorter working hours for women in industry, but employers cut women's pay in proportion to their reduced hours. In one factory, Polish women ripped open their pay envelopes and shouted short pay. In another, Italian women led a massive walkout. Within days, 10,000 workers were on strike, nearly all of them immigrants. Italians made up the largest portion of an incredibly diverse group that included Syrians, Russians, Armenians, Turks, Belgians, Austrians, Irish, and English workers. And then I just have one more. I'll read one more section. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and Big Bill Haywood built solidarity in Lawrence by organizing special meetings for women. Haywood had cut his teeth with the Western Federation of Miners, a union that won tough strikes in isolated areas by building strong networks of family and community support. Flynn worked to keep women in sympathy with the strike by articulating the special challenges they faced as workers. Many became pregnant while working in the mills. They stood at their looms until their labor pains began, miscarried from the strain, or sought dangerous illegal abortions. They had little time to rest once their children were born. Eager to get back to work in order to feed their families, they left their undernourished infants in day nurseries. Nearly one-third of the babies born to female factory workers died during the first month. To Flynn, these cold facts of life spoke to the ruthless invasion of family life by capitalism. In the socialist future projected by the IWW, women who became mothers could choose to remain at work or to stay at home and care for their children. The free choice of work is the IWW ideal, Flynn explained, for women as well as men.
Lara, I just want to stay in the pre-World War I period for a little bit more time because we do have an anniversary coming up of the Triangle Sugar Rush fire. So if you can give us an abbreviated summary of that, I think that would be most helpful for us.
So yes, we are coming up on the anniversary of that tragic event, which occurred on March 25th, 1911, around 4:30 p.m. A fire broke out in the Triangle Waste Factory on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of a building on Washington Square Park. Firemen rushed to the scene, but the exits were locked, and their ladders did not reach beyond the 6th floor. 146 workers died, either by jumping to their death or perishing inside the building. Most of the workers who perished were young immigrant women who had migrated to the United States from Russia, Eastern Europe, and Italy. And, you know, just kind of compounding the tragedy, I think, was the fact that this occurred really the year after the uprising of the 20,000. And actually, the workers of Triangle had been on strike against the company, but Triangle was one of the shops that did not settle. It resisted the union. You know, the fact that it resisted the union and then it was the site of this terrible workplace tragedy a year later just says a lot about what labor unions did and still do to protect workers.
The garment industry has a special meaning for me, both as my mother was a garment worker, and I was the head at one point of the sportswear joint board of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union that organized worker centers in the Bronx, mostly dealing with people, immigrant workers who did homework and who had no rights. And there's still numerous shops. Such as the garment industry is in this country today. Of course, it's been largely globalized, but where people are doing homework, as we called it, and have no health and safety precautions and so on. So talk more about, you know, you focused a lot on the issue of immigrant women, and I'm thinking about how, again, the garment industry has become globalized. And what were the lessons, really, of the uprising of the 20,000 and from the terrifying tragedy, still one of the worst in the world, although right up there is another one in Bangladesh, the Rana Plaza building collapse, where over 1,000 people were killed, mostly women. So talk to us about really what has happened in that particular industry and with women since.
The garment industry still, it's still an industry that tends to employ a lot of women. And unfortunately, it's still an industry that remains very dangerous for its workers. I mean, I think much less so in the United States, luckily, but still, as the Rana Plaza disaster shows, you know, still can be very dangerous in places like Bangladesh. And, you know, I think really.
And we should just say that the building collapsed in Bangladesh where there were garment workers. And as I said, over 1,000 were killed and 2,000 more injured. And it was the deadliest accident in garment history.
Yes, yes, exactly. And again, most of the victims were girls and women because they're most likely to be working in the garment industry. You know, I think what that accident shows and just, again, really what the Triangle Shirtwaist fire shows is really just how important it is for workers to be organized. And this is something that, you know, Flynn talked about, too, just the fact that having labor regulations on the books, like, that's not enough. The workers themselves need to be organized to be sure that those are properly enforced. The workers need to be listened to because they're the ones that often know when safety standards aren't being followed. So, you know, if they have a voice in their workplace through a union, their workplace is just much like, you know, it's likely to be much safer. But really what happened in New York is that part of what happened is that the workers did organize and the workers in New England also organized. That was kind of an early center of the garment industry. And in the 1930s, a lot of garment manufacturing moved to the South, and that was really to get away from the unions. I mean, that's a reason companies started moving South. And certainly the ILGWU, you know, made some great efforts to organize in the South. But then from there, they moved, by the 1960s, they moved offshore to Mexico, and then it kind of just went on from there. They moved to Asia, and, you know, it's really just kind of the search for cheap labor, I think, and as few regulations as they can find.
I'm most interested also in, as we progress today, women in the workforce. And mm-hmm. we've talked about largely immigrant and very often Eastern European women in the workforce and garment and so on. And then we have domestic workers, and we have nannies, and we have the house cleaners and the care workers, almost all of whom are Black and brown people. There's a number of Asian Pacific Islanders that are filtering in there, too. So where are we now in terms of low-wage women workers mm-hmm. in the workforce, and also the recognition still of the enormity of their power as organizers, not merely just as victims of the abusive capitalist crush that they have faced in their specific industries?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think sometimes, you know, the triangle fire, the aftermath sort of gets abbreviated, and people think, okay, well, this was the beginning of labor regulations, and, you know, everything got better for women. And it certainly, it was significant, and the beginnings of labor regulation for women in industry was really important. And that set the stage for broader labor regulations in general. During the New Deal, specifically, that's when you started to have things like an eight-hour day and minimum wage and stuff like that. But one of the things that I don't know if everyone is aware of is that initially domestic workers and agricultural workers were left out of the Fair Labor mm-hmm. Standards Act. And so workers in those sectors have had to fight really hard to be included. And I mean, I think just to focus on domestic workers, they have had to organize, they've had to seek alliances, you know, just as those industrial workers did. And they're involved now in, there's some, you know, really great efforts to organize. The Domestic Workers Alliance has been really active. They're really active in New York, and they've passed a domestic worker bill of rights. So it's really important for the workers, you know, to have their own organization. I think it's also important, I mean, I think outside agencies, like, for example, the International Labor Organization, or the ILO, has paid a lot of attention to domestic workers in recent years. And I think that's been really helpful, you know, to kind of press forward and say, if we're going to have decent work, you know, that needs to be decent work for everyone, including the care workers, you know, the people whose work and labor makes it possible for a lot of other family, you know, a lot of employing families to function. And then also just to recognize domestic work as labor. There was sort of this old-fashioned assumption, and this goes back to, you know, 100 years ago, that women who were working in households were not the imperiled industrial workers or the imperiled, you know, shop girls that you read about in books like Sister Carrie. So there was just this kind of overlooking of domestic labor as being real work, even though it was wage work, and it really varied a lot regionally who did it. At this point, as you point out, most of the people who are doing domestic workers are doing domestic work in American cities are immigrants. They're women from the Philippines. They're women from the Caribbean. So they're immigrants. Sometimes their citizen status is insecure, so that becomes another factor. But yeah, nonetheless, they're involved in some really significant organizing efforts.
So where do you think we are in other fields today? I mean, no matter how much progress or how much we're fighting, or rather the women are fighting, there are always some jobs that are totally resistant to women entry. I mean, we had Rosie the Riveter show that women can do it and do it better than many, many cases during World War II when they were allowed in the factories. What about today? Where is that line and how do we break it? How do women break it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think, you know, there's the ongoing problem of sort of informal segregation by gender and race as well, frankly, in the workforce. And then there's, you know, there's another problem that's maybe not quite as obvious, which is issues of childcare and parental leave and things like that. I mean, there have been some interesting studies that show, you know, if you look at professional women, if they don't have children, they can do just about as well as men. But once they have children, then they tend to fall behind because they have to take time off. They often don't have adequate childcare. Sometimes, you know, women, they end up leaving the workforce temporarily to take care of their families. I mean, I really think, honestly, if we're going to see like real progress in terms of women's employment, we also have to look at the fact that women have a lot of family responsibilities. That's another debate. You know, should women be exclusively responsible for childcare, housework? Like, no, I would argue. But I just think there really needs to be more social support for motherhood, you know, and that's something that really would go back to something that Elizabeth Gurley Flynn would have argued, which would have been to say women workers, they might be mothers too, and if they want to be able to combine motherhood with wage work, they should be able to do that safely. So I think that really that, I mean, it's not sort of an obvious answer to your question, but I think that would actually open up a lot of doors for women if there was not that, you know, kind of limit placed upon them. Just, I mean, really basic things like paid family leave. And, I mean, I'm using women in sort of the old-fashioned, you know, use of the term, but I think this could apply to a lot of different work, you know, this could apply to workers of different genders. It doesn't just have to be women. But that would be to kind of think about, I guess, you know, almost getting back to that bread and roses idea. Like, think about, you know, what is the work-life balance and what does that look like? And because women generally have more care responsibilities, I think that becomes another way in which they're sort of disadvantaged within the labor force.
I also think they're disadvantaged when it comes to organized labor. And I'm always on a tear and so on with this. And what I mean by that is when you look at the kind of demands, even the demands of the first Labor Day, goodness, in Union Square, they were so much more progressive than where we are today. And I resent profoundly that once again, women in organized labor, where the hell have the unions been on these primary social issues, issues of pay equity, issues of gender equity, issues of watching for 50 years the unraveling of Roe and control over one's body and reproductive services, all these fundamental issues that govern our lives. There's been barely a mumbling word from organized labor on these fundamental issues. What responsibilities and where do we see organized labor taking up the social issues that are still rendering women very much second-class citizens at all.
Yeah, I think that that's a great point. I mean, and I would just, but yeah, organized labor, I mean, I think part of what's hard for organized labor right now is they're just in such a defensive crouch because they're so under attack and labor standards are so under attack that, yeah, you know, these social rights, I think that they have really fallen by the wayside, you know, and sometimes you see actually a stronger articulation of them from groups like the IWW, you know, 100 years ago. They were taught, you know, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was out there talking about birth control, which is pretty interesting, and support for motherhood. It's kind of, I think what you're saying is, you know, it's sort of like a more expansive vision for labor and more support for people beyond just like limiting it strictly to the workplace. Because, of course, you know, our lives don't divide like that, right?
Lara, I want you to continue to do your writing, continue to be a guest of ours, continue to help us explore these issues, and do what? Well, educate, agitate, and organize to empower women, to empower the entire working class. And we have some serious work to do, but some serious examples to learn from. And thank you for sharing those with us. And I have to say, well, during this International Women's History Month, Building Bridges really sends special solidarity to women workers, people of all genders, and oppressed people around the world. And with champions like Lara Vapnik, we will make this a spring that is filled with renewal and hope and for self-determination and equal
Wonderful.
Rights and justice. Lara, you're delightful. Thank you so much for the work that you do and for being with us on Building Bridges.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed it.
Good. And we'll have Lara back for sure. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
Book also. Wonderful books. And I'm Ken Nash.
And we are Building Bridges. Thanks for listening. Organize.